From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. A tornado whipped through southeast Alabama yesterday evening along the Georgia border, causing widespread damage in Talbot, Muskogee, Harris, and Grady counties. It touched down in Lee County, Alabama, where the county sheriff reported 23 people have died thus far. GPB reporter Grant Blankenship is reporting on the storm's impact in Georgia and joins us now. Grant, welcome.
Thanks. Good morning.
So when were residents in the area warned about the possibility of a tornado?
So this all sort of ran between about noon until around 6 o'clock last night. And what you saw during the day were these tornado warnings popping up like popcorn on the map all across this belt running from Columbus to about Sparta, midway between Macon and Augusta. Of course, the most deadly tornado that was spawned by these storms killed those 23 people you mentioned in Lee County, Alabama, and that was just across the river from Columbus, from across the Chattahoochee River from Columbus, Georgia. There was also a second line of storms way far south Alabama into far south Georgia that caused a lot of damage and apparently also tornadoes.
And south Georgia, the same areas possibly hit by Hurricane Michael?
Right, yeah. So according to the Tallahassee Democrat, there was a tornado from that second line of storms that destroyed, you know, a dozen homes and businesses in the town of Cairo. That's between Bainbridge and Thomasville. And yeah, that's right in the middle of that 20-county area that was hit so hard by Hurricane Michael last year.
Well, can you give us a sense, Grant, of the communities there in these areas that were affected?
Right, well, so Cairo, like I said, is already in a place where people are waiting for assistance from the last disaster, you know, Hurricane Michael at the end of the year. In the middle part of the state, a tornado destroyed a few homes in Peach and Crawford counties. And if you saw videos on social media of this particular tornado, it was huge. And the fact that it only destroyed a couple of homes and resulted in, I think, one broken limb. That was the only injury. It's sort of amazing.
So this much more devastating, especially in Lee County, Alabama, 23 dead, as reported. This happened on Sunday night. What kind of recovery efforts are on the way?
Well, you know, in Alabama, they're still searching for people. I think the number is at least 23. I don't think they're confident that that's the final tally of fatalities there. In South Georgia, again, people are still waiting for recovery assistance from Hurricane Michael, and this just piles on to that difficulty of getting back on your feet after that event. You know, in Middle Georgia, I think for the most part, people are probably, you know, shaking their heads, saying, you know, we kind of dodged a bullet, and, you know, waiting for insurance adjusters to come and make the houses right again. But I think people in our part of the state are probably relieved that it wasn't any worse than it was.
Well, Grant, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Stay tuned to GPB and NPR throughout the day for updates on the tornado. The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, and other media are reporting that the U.S. and China are closer to an agreement on trade. They're citing anonymous sources briefed on the matter. Last week, the Trump administration waived its deadline for imposing additional tariffs on China. But talks over the weekend could mean a reduction in tariffs by both countries to pre-trade dispute levels. The new signals relief for many affected Georgia industries. And here to talk about what it could mean for the state's economy is Jeffrey Dorfman. He's professor of agriculture and applied economics at the University of Georgia and director of UGA's Land Use Studies Initiative, joining us now on the line from WUGA Studios in Athens. Welcome, Jeffrey.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. And Vivian Yue is an associate professor of economics at Emory University. She's also a research associate for the National Bureau of Economic Research, and she's with me in the studio. Vivian, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Vivian, this is not a final pact yet, but where did the U.S. and China get to over the weekend?
So we have got some source information saying that the China and the U.S. are in the final stage of completing the trade deal.
Mm-hmm. So are they saying that they could lift all or most U.S. tariffs, or what are the contingencies here?
So what we know is that China is offering to lower tariffs on American agricultural goods, chemical, auto, and other products, and also remove some restrictions. And Washington is considering removing most, if not all, sanctions against China.
So what are the contingencies here? Intellectual property rights had been a big source of trouble. What's happening there? Do we know?
So we don't know much yet. What we know is that this the provision on strengthening the intellectual property rights is pretty complicated and still under negotiation.
Yeah, so obviously this is not finished. But Georgia farmers, of course, might be breathing a sigh of relief today. If information leaked to these news organizations is correct, China would lift all tariffs on U.S. agricultural goods. Jeffrey, how important would that outcome be?
It is quite important to the income levels of Georgia farmers. In the United States, we export about 25% of all our agricultural production. And China is a very important market for us nationally. And for Georgia specifically, we do send them cotton and soybeans and pecans.
Mm-hmm. And I understand that poultry products were exempt from this tariff deal from the beginning.
So China is not accepting any poultry products from the United States now over worries about avian flu. We're certainly hoping that as part of China's pledge to buy $30 billion a year and more in agricultural products, that they might remove that blockade on our poultry and start buying some of our poultry products.
Mm-hmm. And what was the effect of the tariffs for Georgia farmers in general? We've spoken to some who said, you know, a pecan farmer said, I have no orders on the books this season.
Yeah, pecan farmers in particular were hard hit because there isn't any other buyer on the scale of China that they can sell to instead. And we lost about half our pecan crop this year thanks to Hurricane Michael. And normally what would have happened is Georgia farmers would have had half the pecans to sell, but price would have gone up to help compensate for those losses. Instead, because we lost the Chinese market, prices for pecans have stayed about exactly where they normally are. And so farmers took about a 50% income hit thanks to this trade war with China.
If China did eliminate all tariffs on U.S. agricultural goods, would that be a victory, Jeffrey, or just a reset to what was in place before the trade tensions escalated?
There were some agricultural tariffs before this trade war escalated. So if they actually didn't just go back to the previous status quo, but got rid of all tariffs, it would be a win for American farmers.
Now, you mentioned that pecan farmers especially hard hit, but once you're out of the supply chain, for example, if China is buying pecans from someplace else, from Brazil, for example, what happens once you're out of the supply chain? How do you get back in?
Sure, that can be difficult, and there are worries about that with some of our products, but luckily, particularly for pecans, China is such a big part of the worldwide demand that they really can't fill their orders from someplace else easily. And so we're pretty confident they will come back to our farmers for pecans and probably for soybeans when this is over.
I'm going to stay on agriculture for a minute with you, Jeffrey. The federal government allocated about $12 billion in relief funds for farmers affected by trade tensions. Georgia cotton farmers seeing some relief. But, Jeffrey, have those dollars offset the blow to Georgia agriculture?
No, for Georgia agriculture, they have not. Almost all of the money designated for trade relief went to people who grow soybeans. And that's not a huge crop here in Georgia, although we do grow some. So our farmers that grow cotton and pecans definitely were not made whole by the trade.
Vivian, the other industry caught up in the retaliatory tariffs is manufacturing. Kia plant in West Point, Georgia, employs some 14,000 workers. Lockheed Martin in Cobb County saw prices on their raw materials go up when tariffs announced on steel and aluminum imports last summer, not just China, but Europe and Canada. How have they been affected?
Yeah, so exactly. So when this trade war started, we see that importers are affected, and 40% of the U.S. imports from China actually are parts, components, and all these intermediate goods and raw materials. With the cost of these products, these materials high-rocking and increase, that cuts the firm's competitiveness and therefore kind of affects the employment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Have people been fired? Do we know that? I'm maybe asking you something that's beyond your ken.
Sorry, I don't have the exact number, but just looking at the bright side, if a trade deal is reached, I'm sure all these companies and also automaking industries, food processing industries, all these industries which play a major role here in Georgia's economy will benefit to a great extent.
Right, auto industries and food processing. But how about, you know, the big headquarters? You know, Mercedes-Benz and Porsche have headquarters in Atlanta. French automaker group, PSA, opening a home here also. How have these companies fared under this double whammy with trade disputes over both metal parts and cars themselves?
Yeah, so I think auto industry definitely is a very important part of this trade deal agreement. So I think China now is offering to speed up the timetable to remove foreign ownership limitations on car ventures and reduce the tariffs on imported vehicles to below the current tariff level of 15%. So all these companies, they will benefit.
And they could be selling cars in China in a way that they haven't in the past.
Exactly.
So you said this looks good. If the deal, if the leaked deal works out, what would it actually mean for Georgia Car and other manufacturing companies? Just sales go up, that they are, you know, continue to operate, or just the threat is removed?
Well, I think one thing for sure is that over the past years, there has been this great uncertainty about this trade war, trade tension that will hurt the business. So if that uncertainty is removed, that's good. So in terms of the potential increasing in the market share in China, I don't have the exact number, but I hope the firms operating in Georgia will get a good share.
So not just returning to status quo, but actually making some more money out of this. Well, of course, Vivian, Georgia's economy also made up for some big Fortune 500 and multinational companies. How will some of these big businesses be affected by the deal?
So the other thing, I think all these big companies, and one thing I want to say is that Georgia also plays a big role in transportation, distribution, logistics. We know these companies, they have their headquarters here. Mm-hmm. And they are impacted by the international trade a lot.
Mm-hmm. And so which kind of companies are you talking about?
I'm talking about like UPS, mm-hmm. Delta, and, you know, these companies. And also the ports, right? Ports in Georgia. So a lot of exports and imports, they go through the ports here we have in the state. So during the trade tension, you know, the exports actually is hurt and the imports are hurt. So when there is a trade agreement, so I think Georgia's economy will benefit.
Well, we're going to talk a little bit about how that is going to affect the market, but we are up against a break, and we're talking about what a possible U.S. China trade deal would mean for Georgia's farming manufacturing sectors with Vivian Yue. She's from Emory University. And Jeffrey Dorman is with us from UGA. He's professor of agriculture and applied economics. Let's see. We've got just a minute before the break. What are you thinking, Jeffrey? What are you hearing so far? This is relatively recent news. Are Georgia farmers already celebrating?
Georgia farmers are definitely not celebrating yet. We want the trade deal to be done. We want to see the president sign it, and then we'll start to believe it. And they're also still desperately waiting in hopes that Congress is going to pass disaster relief from Hurricane Michael, money they've been sort of promised for months but still hasn't been approved by Congress.
Well, we'll get to that after just a short break. Be right back with more of On Second Thought, the effect of the possible trade deal on Georgia manufacturing and all of our economy. This is On Second Thought. Stay with us. I'm Virginia Prescott. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott, back with the conversation about what a possible U.S.-China trade deal could mean for Georgia's farming manufacturing sectors, among others. Vivian Yue is with us from Emory University. Jeffrey Dorfman from UGA, where he's professor of agriculture and applied economics. Well, the news here is that the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, other media reporting that the U.S. and China are closer to an agreement on trade. They are citing anonymous sources briefed on the matter over the weekend. So, of course, information about a possible trade deal has been leaked to the media. U.S. markets just opening, but overseas ones have been trading. So if the purpose of the leak is to help the stock market, Vivian, is it working?
So the U.S., the market for We see that in Hang Seng stock market in Hong Kong, it has been opening ends high. And
she's also getting real-time results from your phone here.
Yes. Yeah, so and we'll see very soon how the U.S. market will respond.
Well, some pundits have said that the president is trying to put a positive spin on these talks to keep financial markets stable. What could happen if the uncertainty continues to the markets and the currencies, if we're not sure?
Well, the market doesn't like uncertainty, so so that's why everyone is watching very anxiously about where the trade deal is going. And I want to say something about currency. So here, one part that the U.S. is asking China to do is to, part of the deal we know is that the U.S. is pushing China to keep renminbi stable against the U.S. dollar. So I think that's something China, we'll see how China will respond to this request. So
I'm also seeing reports that it may be difficult for China to sell this deal back home and maybe for President Trump to sell this deal. But from a Chinese perspective, what is President Xi looking for and what does he want to tell his public?
Yeah, exactly. I think actually for both countries, they may the presidents, both presidents may face some pressure from domestic. So here, you know, we have know that there is some nationalist sentiment in China, mm-hmm. especially after the rest of the Meng Wanzhou from Huawei. And now, if U.S. is asking China to do something on the currency, well, China has been has depreciated its currency against the U.S. dollars quite a bit, has appreciated, from 2005 to 2013. And after that, China started some more market-determined exchange rate policy to gain more flexibility. So now, right now, if U.S. wants to ask China to step back and to put more heavy hand on renminbi, it probably will be hard to get agreement. We will see. And also, renminbi is not, I have done some research on this, renminbi is not just a pact against dollar anymore. China tries to gain some flexibility as well, some stability against a basket of currency. So I think this will be condition that's pretty hard to sell within China.
Yeah, I can understand. But how about here, Jeffrey, in the U.S., there are those, among them, Senator Johnny Isaacson, who voted to push for a trade agreement and end the trade war. What kind of national pressure is coming on the president from people like the ag interests in Georgia?
I think there's a lot of pressure. Republicans in general like free trade and like to let businesses get about their business, and so have not enjoyed supporting President Trump on his trade restrictions and tariffs as a negotiating tool. So I think the Republican Party, I think the sort of Chamber of Commerce, and I think farmers all across America are really hoping to see some settlements soon and get back to trading, or, you know, either as we were before or under better conditions.
Well, what is going to happen immediately, we don't know. Of course, there's going to be a meeting planned between the president, President Trump, and Chinese President Xi Jinping later this month at Mar-a-Lago. If a deal is reached, Jeffrey, would things just go back to normal?
It's a fascinating question. China has supposedly offered to buy $30 billion a year more in agricultural products. And it's actually rather hard to try and identify what that $30 billion a year would be. There aren't that many extra soybeans, pecans, peanuts. So are they going to buy more cotton? Are they going to reopen their markets to poultry products? You know, exactly how do they plan to keep this promise is something that nobody's been able to figure out yet.
There are a couple of schools of thought on benefits of tariffs, but as proposed, you know, you improve the domestic economy when international goods are more expensive, increases demand for domestic goods, hopefully creates more jobs. Jeffrey, what have we seen here in this trade dispute that really began about 8 months ago?
Well, what we see in all trade disputes is not that it increases domestic jobs. It actually hurts the domestic economy. You protect jobs in a favored industry, but you lose more jobs in the rest of the industry. So we, for example, protected some steelworker jobs, but lost more auto worker jobs than steelworker jobs were saved because automakers use steel to make cars. And by making steel more expensive, meant that they could sell fewer cars and therefore made fewer cars. So we know we're losing from this trade war. The question is whether it's worth those short-term losses to get some long-term gains. And we won't know until we see what the deal is and then whether the parties stick to the deal through the future years.
So that is all a projection yet to be answered. But we've talked to several farmers or people in industry here in Georgia who said, you know, we're just going to wait it out and trust. But how about economists on who pays for tariffs? You know, exporters cut prices on goods. Does that make they make them less expensive so consumers pay less, or consumers end up paying increased costs? Any data on who really bore the brunt of this?
There is. There's actually a couple of studies just out today, in fact, that I heard about that show that almost the entirety, if not the entirety, of the tariff costs were paid by American consumers, not by the Chinese exporters. So we never know in advance exactly who's going to get stuck with the bill, but it appears that at least in this case, it was the American consumer.
Okay, so either view. How is the instability from these trade talks perhaps impacting trade relationships with other countries?
Well, one thing is, I know, as part of the discussion, China also offers to, you know, buy more of the U.S. goods, but you know, one where all these imports to China should come from. So before that will be impacted the trade relationship with the other countries, I would say.
And for you, Jeffrey, if you're, you know, if you were negotiating with China right now, what would you try to secure for industries and workers in Georgia?
I think we should be worried about the barriers for foreign investment in China and about trying to make sure they don't use non-tariff barriers, so, for example, blocking our poultry products because of claims they're worried about avian flu when there's more of it there than there is here, for example. So we just want open markets, a fair shot at a deal, and we're convinced that American farmers and American manufacturers can compete with anybody if we're given that fair chance.
Jeffrey Dorfman, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Happy to have been on with you.
Jeffrey Dorfman, he's professor of agriculture and applied economics at the University of Georgia. And Vivian Yuan, she is associate professor of economics at Emory University. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
As the Savannah Stopover Music Festival heads into its ninth year, one featured artist won't have to travel far, singer and songwriter Aaron Paul Zimmer, who calls Savannah home. Aaron Paul Zimmer singing Windows here.
You know the morning comes so easy when I spend my time with you. My breath becomes so deep and sweet when we kiss that morning dew.
Aaron Paul Zimmer there singing Windows again from his new solo album. It's called Saints and Heretics, and he's joining us from our Savannah Bureau. Hello, Aaron.
Hey, good morning.
Well, good morning to you. You started playing live in clubs and bars in Athens, right, when you were a student at UGA?
Yes, that's correct. Yes, that's correct.
So you had a lot of practice in the college town filled with the younger audience. I'm wondering about your first performance.
It was a good town to cut my teeth in. There's so many great venues in Athens. You know, I think the first live show that I played with my college roommate was at a place called DT's Underground, which I don't believe is still there. But we played pretty much all over town, some really good clubs. There was a club called Tasty World. We ended up playing at the 40 Watt, which was very nice. But so many good venues there. I met some really nice people, good musicians, and like I said, a great place to cut my teeth.
Well, it's been 10 years since you've released a solo album. Now you've got another one out this year. Let's hear just a little bit from this song, Two Doors Down, from the record.
Doors down, there's a jukebox that plays all night long real sad songs about me and you. And two doors down, there's a barmaid that serves them real strong, and here lately, so I make it through.
That to me sounds a little bit like, I don't know, an old Merle Haggard era country song. Lots of twang in that one.
Yeah, that's actually a cover of a song called Two Doors Down by Dwight Yoakam. And that was the first song that we recorded for this record. And just to clarify, this is my first solo album. But there's a funny story behind that song. I was playing late night at a great bar called The Jinx in Savannah. And I was, you know, it was just late night. I'd been there for several hours. And a guy approached me as I was playing that song, and his name was Matt Collette, and he had been there for a long time, too. And I think, you know, we were both just kind of worn out. And he came up and said that, you know, as I was playing that song, that it really struck a chord with him, no pun intended. But he said that he would like to record that song as part of a compilation CD of Savannah artists. But that led to us, you know, recording two more songs, and then we thought about doing an EP of, you know, five or six songs. But then eventually it just led to being a full-length album. And now Matt Collette and his partner in running their studio, The Garage, in Savannah, Colin Motlaw, are now performing live with me at the Savannah Stopover. So good buddies of mine and great guys, and they did me a solid for sure by helping me get this record done.
Yeah, well, you did also work with the band, the award-winning bluegrass band City Hotel. Here's a little bit from their third album. It's called Don't Go to the Porch.
Don't go to the porch, mama, you'll see what I've done. The way you look at things makes you see a problem. Don't go to the porch, mama, you'll see what I've done. Don't go to the porch, cause there ain't one.
So much different feel there. Obviously, a whole different band. Did you feel like you were striking out on something different in doing this album on your own?
I did. You know, a lot of these songs have been, on my back burner for about, like I said, about 10 years. And it's something I've had in my mind for about that long. It's a total departure from City Hotel. So a total departure from everything that I've done thus far. Doing a solo record is difficult because, you know, when you have a band, there's four people there to help you, you know, split the costs and the work of doing that. But so it took me a while, but, you know, I'm very happy with the end result, and I'm very excited. But yeah, a total departure from that sound for sure.
Yeah. And also a total, you know, this is all your own. This is very personal in a way. How does that feel to put that out there in the world?
It is. It's very rewarding, and I feel very fortunate that it's gotten the response that it has. I've gotten a lot of help from people in Savannah, and it's very special to me to put this out and to be just my own, just songs that I've written, because I've co-written a lot of material with City Hotel, but it's something totally different to just have a whole solo record. So that's pretty special to me. But I owe a lot of thanks to many different people around town. A lot of Savannah musicians stepped forward and helped me put this out and played on the record. Sometimes spent long hours for free, contributing to this. So it was not just me getting it accomplished. I owe a lot of thanks to a lot of people.
Well, the song we just heard from City Hotel was Don't Go to the Porch. And you have been described as a front porch Sinatra. How do you think you earned that moniker?
I think that was Anna Chandler.
You're not really a crooner. I don't hear a crooner there.
No, I'm not. That was Anna Chandler that wrote that. She's a journalist in Savannah and a good buddy of ours. But I think she was just talking about my voice. And I feel that, you know, as a performer, my voice is probably my strongest thing that I offer to a band, my voice and my writing. But he wasn't really a big influence of mine. I do appreciate his work. Not a huge influence of mine.
Well, your voice is a big part of it, but also your lyrics. I hear a lot. I don't know. It sounds to me like a little bit of settling into domesticity, you know, just sort of like coming back home. I don't know. Am I guessing wrong here? Is there a part of your life that's settling?
It is. Yeah, I'm coming into a very new part of my life right now. My wife and I are expecting our first child.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you very much. We're closing on a house in about 2 weeks. For the first time, I've got a job that I really feel comfortable in, and as you know, pays well, and I've got retirement, all that kind of stuff. So it's a kind of a comfort of settling in, and a comfort of security, but also a comfort of, you know, kind of putting out a solo record for the first time. So I'm in a good place. I don't think I've ever been as busy as I am right now, but I feel very much alive too.
Well, let's listen to a little bit more of the song from the album. This is called Boy in the Sun.
But I'm sitting here in the sun, watching my skin grow old, thinking about some things I said a long, long time ago. And I'm sitting here and thinking.
Well, Aaron Paul Zimmer, I want to thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thanks very much for having me.
Savannah singer and songwriter Aaron Paul Zimmer. His new album is called Saints and Heretics, now available online. He's performing on Thursday at the Savannah Stopover Music Festival. You can find more details on the album and festival at gpbnews.org.
When I climbed out, he was a different person. Nobody else was ever able to tell.
From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Last spring, five African-American women were asked to leave a Pennsylvania golf course after being told they were moving too slowly. The incident made headlines after a video showing a confrontation between them and the white owners of the club went viral.
We asked you three times now to remove yourself from the premises. You have yet to remove yourself.
And why is it that we took? Why did you say you would remove us from the premises? What was the confrontation? You came to us. We were trying to.
State lawmakers did call for an investigation following the incident, which highlighted a sport in which 90% of players are white and most of them are men, and where business deals and networking get done. Tiffany Fitzgerald hopes to bring more diversity to the green. She's founder of Black Girls Golf in Atlanta, but is connecting black women who want to learn, practice, and play golf nationwide. Good morning, Tiffany.
Good morning.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Why did you learn to play golf?
You know, corporate America is one of those spaces where there are formal and informal networks, and golf is one of those informal networks that women are often excluded from. And I recognized that immediately and decided I want to be where the influencers are, where the men in positions of power are making those decisions. I need to be there. So I learned how to play.
So were you working in corporate America at the time?
Yes, I was working in corporate America. I was bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and checked all the boxes, go to college, get a power suit, do all those things, but golf was never on the list of to-dos for me.
So were you ever invited to play golf?
No, I was not invited. People assumed I didn't play, and they weren't wrong. I didn't play. And that's the assumption I think many men make about women, and black women in particular, that we don't play, so we don't get invited.
Well, let's pick up on that story we heard a little of at the top. The officers arrived there, quickly decided this was not a police issue. No charges were filed, but though several Pennsylvania lawmakers did call for a state investigation, and several people did boycott the club. But when you were hearing about this, you know, was this a real thing for you when you started in the sport?
Sadly enough, I was not surprised by this incident. Being a golfer and being in corporate America, I'm often in spaces where I'm the only woman or the only person of color in the room. And you get used to being in those spaces, but you never get used to being treated that way. And so for me, this wasn't about pace of play. This is about golf's racist history coming back to bite them. And I hope this incident, you know, kind of shook the industry up a little bit because they've really been late to evolve. And this was two worlds kind of clashing, which is crazy to say. You know, this incident happened in 2018, but in 2018, two worlds colliding like that. Number one, I wasn't surprised. Number two, this had nothing to do with pace of play. And number three, it really underscored the importance of the work I'm doing with Black Girls Golf and our foundation, Black Girls Golf Foundation for Diversity and Inclusion. There's a lot of work that needs to be done.
Well, that's what you saw. You were out. So what was your first time like out on the green?
I was completely intimidated. You know, golf has lots of rules and unwritten etiquette. And if you don't know those things, it is completely intimidating. I didn't take enough lessons, so I was swinging and missing. You know, if you're the only woman in a foursome, the men are all watching you. You know, you're on the tee box and everyone's watching you, and you do that 18 times. So it was super intimidating. I had never been so intimidated in my life and uncomfortable, and I didn't want to go back, frankly. I was like, I'm over this. I can't do this again. I know why women don't play now.
Well, how soon after that did you start the organization, Black Girls Golf?
It was about 5 years after that. You know, I took an absence from the game, but it kept coming up in corporate America, golf is going to come up so many times. And I didn't want to keep saying no to those invitations, because once people find out you can play, you do start to get the invitations. And I was saying no because I was so uncomfortable. So I committed to learning more. And once I learned more about the industry, I understood that, you know, this is a space where women can really find some opportunities and build relationships with their male colleagues. But when we're not there, our voices are not part of the conversation.
So did you find yourself, as projected, climbing through the corporate culture as you started to golf?
You know, it's so funny. I was known as the black girl in marketing. No one even had to know my name because I was the only one. And once I started playing golf, I skipped a step. I went from the black girl in marketing to Tiff. I got a nickname. I started getting invitations. So things really did change for me at work. I gained more confidence. I was more confident around men in the office. Things, the dynamic for me at work changed. And it was because I was building better relationships with my colleagues.
So you started Black Girls Golf. What was the response to people, from people saying, you know, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this thing that's countering a long history of African-Americans and women being excluded from the field.
Absolutely.
Or the green, I should say.
So I posted something on Facebook and 26 women showed up. And it was amazing, although it was a disaster. Their first time out with a group of women who had no clue what to do was a disaster. But it let me know that black women do have an appetite for this sport. They understand the importance of learning how to play. They just don't have a platform to do it.
So is that part of it? You're teaching people how to play and then getting that, what, networking on their own?
We are providing access to professional golf instructors, PGA and LPGA, teachers. We're giving them access to the golf course and making it more comfortable for them to be there.
Here is senior accountant Joy Matthews. She's talking about how Black Girls Golf impacted her life.
I was 27 when I lost my father. It kind of sent me through a depression stage where it was hard for me to be social. I just didn't want to be around people. I didn't know how to be around people. Black Girls Golf helped me therapeutically get out and kind of talk to people and open me up.
So it's more than just business.
It is absolutely more than just business. It is about relationships. I tell women the golf is secondary. It's not really about the golf. Although you have to know what to do, it's not about the golf. It's about the relationships. It's about spending that one-on-one intimate time with someone that you normally wouldn't get.
What does that do? What does that golf game do?
You know, it levels the playing field. People are more relaxed. People are less formal, and you're really getting to know people. You're getting to see their character. How do they respond after a bad shot? You get to celebrate your competitor, you know, telling people good shot. You get to be supportive with one another. And then you've got 4 hours of uninterrupted time in close proximity with another person that you ordinarily wouldn't have, especially in the hustle bustle of day-to-day life. People just don't take time to slow down and do that.
Had you participated in any other sports before this?
I ran track growing up, but that was it. Golf was not in my frame of reference at all.
I think it isn't for a lot of, you know, first of all, it's prohibitively expensive for a lot of people. You know, even you don't have to be African-American or a woman to know that.
Right. But it doesn't have to be. And, you know, some of the things we do are give women tips about how to make golf less expensive, make it more affordable and less cost prohibitive for them. There's some tips and tricks that we normally share because we want them to have fun, but we also want it to be affordable as well.
But that air of exclusivity, you know, is that what you're doing, sort of penetrating that a little bit by little bit?
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the things that keeps people away from the sport. It was one of the things that attracted people at one time was the exclusivity of it. But it also is one of the things that keeps people from getting in the game as well.
We're speaking with Tiffany Fitzgerald. She's founder and CEO of Black Girls Golf, which you started it here in Atlanta, but you reached out, what? Where are your people now?
So we started Black Girls Golf here in Atlanta, but we have now more than 4,000 members in 38 states and 9 countries.
Wow. Wow. So are they these little satellites? Are they starting other? How does this model work?
We don't operate on a traditional chapter model. However, we do encourage women to host small groups, and we have a mobile app that you can use to contact other members directly. You can set a geofence to find members within a 20-mile radius, a 50-mile radius, whatever's comfortable for you. We've had several small group meetups right here in Atlanta where women are opening their homes to other Black Girls Golf members and getting to know each other. It's really a sisterhood, a family, if you will, that we're creating because, you know, women need that camaraderie and that support, and that's what Black Girls Golf provides.
Well, let's look at, you mentioned something about the racist history of golf. Althea Gibson became the first Black woman to play in the ladies' professional PGA, Professional Golf Association, 1963, defying discriminatory norms, but segregation at golf courses was common. What do we know about the history of how golf courses or the sport of golf kept people out?
So the PGA of America, which is 101 years old now, they had a Caucasian-only clause until 1961.
Wow.
So we're not very far removed from a time when African Americans were not allowed to play in competitive ranks of the PGA of America. Here in the state of Georgia, actually, one of the first separate but equal fights for public parks, golf courses were part of that. So right here in Georgia, you know, golf has kind of, you know, kind of shed some of its racist skin right here in the state of Georgia with opening up public parks to African Americans.
Are there still clubs that don't admit women?
There are few. The RNA, St. Andrews, the birthplace of golf, they are now allowing women on certain days and certain times, certain times a day and certain days of the week. But most clubs that are very exclusive, you have to be a member and the members have to be voted in. And that's kind of how you keep things exclusive, is based on who you're voting in. And oftentimes it's not women or people of color.
So going beyond your work with women on the green, you're also helping young girls with education. Clemson partnered with Black Girls Golf to provide 15 scholarships to Black Girls Golf students to attend Clemson and the PGA Golf Management Summer Scholars Program. Why did Clemson get involved?
So Clemson is part of a group of colleges and universities that host a program called the Professional Golf Management Program. And you're in essence getting like a minor in golf management. You're learning the business side of the industry. But African American women make up less than 1% of the golf industry's workforce. So there is no pipeline for African American women getting into careers in the industry. And Clemson is the closest program to me here in Atlanta. So I partnered with them, and now we're bringing in girls from all over the country to experience a week-long at Clemson, learning what it feels like to be a student in the Professional Golf Management Program at Clemson University. And just Saturday, we had a fundraiser, an annual fundraiser. We raised more than $50,000. So we're hoping to be able to give a deserving student a four-year scholarship that will help her pay for her education if she decides to go to Clemson.
That is real real strategy there, right?
Absolutely.
You get people in the pipeline, in the industry, and
Absolutely.
That changes things. It is Women's History Month, and you are obviously making a real difference in the community with young women pursuing higher ed and interested in sports. So do you have advice to youth about innovation and creating opportunities for Black girls in sports?
I think the first thing you have to remember, you know, as a young woman, is that there are still so many spaces where you may not feel safe, where your womanhood may not be protected. But when you find a support system, you know, building your own village and building your own community, you'll find the support, you'll find other people that share a passion for what you love, and then you can start to take the steps to do the things that absolutely have to be done. Like doing the work that I'm doing with Black Girls Golf, it has to be done. But I don't do it alone. And it is with a lot of support. It is with the community that I built who helps motivate me and reminds me about why I do it. Because sometimes this work can be thankless and it can be challenging and it can be difficult. Like I get hate mail often.
Really? What do people say?
You know, people accuse me of being racist. Because I chose to name it Black Girls Golf, they think that I'm excluding people. And really, I know that people don't go to parties uninvited. And Black Girls Golf is the invitation to the party that I think Black women needed. And I think young girls who have a passion for something, be the invitation to someone. And create a support network of people that can help you invite other women to join you wherever, in whatever space you feel you deserve to be in.
Well, part of that community that you're talking about is you have a blog, Tiff Talks.
Tiff Talks.
Tiff Talks, and you give tips for beginner golfers and really overall write about lifestyle and events. Why this online component?
Because people are online now. You know, you can't live an analog life anymore. So you have to meet people where they are, and people are online, and you want people to be able to access, you know, the information that you have. So in order to be accessible to everyone, you've got to have a space online.
Well, I'm sure that people tell you stories about their experience on the green. What are some of the stories? Anything come to mind of somebody who's really changed their thinking about golf?
You know, I hear stories all the time. One story that really stands out for me really happened at the Clemson golf camp last summer. There was a girl who was the only girl on her golf team. They called it a co-ed golf team because she was the girl. And her mother told me that it was the worst season she ever had. It was very challenging. The boys weren't very kind to her. She was also the only African-American. And she said her daughter lost her love of the game. She never saw her smile with a golf club in her hand that whole season. And I was sharing pictures online about the girls in the camp, and her mother sent me an email before the week was even over. And she said, "Thank you so much for doing this. This is the first time we've seen her smiling with a golf club in her hand all season. She needed this." And, you know, just seeing the girls get to know each other, they're exchanging social media and really becoming very fast friends because most of their experience is being the only one. And seeing them kind of blossom is very, very, very rewarding. And I could tell so many stories about what happens at that camp every year with those girls understanding that I do belong here. There is a space for me. And people do accept who I am and my level of play and my ability and what I'm doing is just right, just perfect for me.
All right, we're up against the break, but long-term goals for Black Girls Golf right now?
I would love for Black Girls Golf to be a household name, but right now we are really focusing on the Black Girls Golf Foundation for Diversity and Inclusion, and we would love to be able to provide scholarships to be able to create that pipeline to create a major impact in the industry by making it more diverse and more inclusive.
Well, Tiffany, thank you so much for being very visible here today.
Thank you so much.
Tiffany Fitzgerald, she's founder and CEO of Black Girls Golf. And that's all we have time for today. I'm Virginia Prescott. On Second Thought is produced by Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, LaRaven Taylor, and Amelia Brock. Alex Word, our engineer, Don Smith, our dean of grammar, and Amy Kiley is a senior producer. Our theme is composed by Alex Crispin and Marshall Ruffin. Well, you can always join the conversation on our Facebook group. We're at GP Radio's On Second Thought, and we're on Twitter at OST Talk, or email us at onsecondthought@gpb.org.